Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time low country visitor.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that respects cinema tradition, even as we as a team embrace new ways of interpreting it. In recent weeks, two giants of cinema have passed on to that great art house in the sky. One, Robert Duvall, is thought of by many of his peers as the actor's actor. The other, Frederick Wiseman, is one of the most respected documentary filmmakers of all time. In an effort to pay homage to both, we thought we'd run down each of their respective careers, discuss what made them special, and share some of what we consider their best efforts. Let's begin with a man who delivered the line that the American Film Institute ranked as number 12 on its list of the top 100 greatest movie quotes of all time. And that quote from Francis Ford Coppola's 1979 film Apocalypse Now is this: "I love the smell of napalm in the morning." And of course, his character, Lieutenant Colonel William Bill Kilgore, follows that with this pungent observation, recalling how he saw napalm wipe out an enemy force. "It smelled," he says, "like victory." Duvall, who was born in 1931, passed away on February 15th at age 95. A native of San Diego, California, Duvall grew up in Maryland and after a short stint in the Army moved to New York, where he began attending theater classes taught by the late, great Sanford Meisner. He began his acting career on the New York stage, moving eventually to Broadway before snaring minor roles in television and finally moving to movies. For a time, he even shared living arrangements with both Dustin Hoffman and Gene Hackman. His first movie role was as the character Boo Radley in Robert Mulligan's 1962 film To Kill a Mockingbird. From there, his movie credits are too numerous to list, though in a moment, the three of us will share our favorites. It's enough to say that he received 5 Oscar nominations as an actor, capped by his Best Actor victory in 1984's Tender Mercies.
Yeah, when I think back on Robert Duvall's career, which I've been doing a lot in the last few weeks, I just think of him as an actor who had an unmistakable power and who had, for lack of a better word, an aura all his own. You know, even in that debut performance in To Kill a Mockingbird that you just mentioned, he only shows up for a few minutes near the end. He doesn't have any lines, but he steps out of those shadows and he makes you think, who is that guy? Yeah. And I don't mean who's the actor, even though that's part of it. It's who is that character and what is his story? He just has something about him that might even just be like what we call je ne sais quoi.
Riz.
he had Riz. That's right. Now, in hindsight, I think that role of Boo Radley has a different impact because we know who Robert Duvall is. We know what he would become after that. But I would imagine that even audiences in 1962, seeing that for the first time, still would have responded to him not knowing who he was.
You have to mention the name Boo Radley.
Oh, yes. And he, of course, not Boo Radley, but Robert Duvall went on to a career that was rich. It was varied. You know, he could be the lead in a movie and carry the whole thing, even though he isn't who I think we would traditionally consider a movie star, but he was a movie star.
No, he wasn't good looking. He was losing his hair. I mean, you know, right, exactly.
He had all the trappings of a character actor, but he could be a movie star if he wanted to.
Which you could also say about Gene Hackman.
Oh,
you
absolutely.
You could also say even about Dustin Hoffman.
Absolutely. And a lot of the guys from that, you know, that kind of came to prominence in that new Hollywood era. I also admired the fact that he would, throughout his career, take on smaller supporting roles and just steal scenes away from everybody. I mean, of those 5 Oscar nominations, I think a majority of them are for supporting actor. He could be really scary. I think he could be imposing. He could be really charming and funny if he wanted to. He could be endearing. And I think that the same actor could play the parts he played in Apocalypse Now, in Network, these firebrands, could then play something as soft-spoken and introverted as the role he won the Oscar for in Tender Mercies. I just think shows that he had such tremendous range. And I kind of feel like that's a thing we don't think about with Robert Duvall, because he did sort of have a type, especially later in his career. But he did have range. Mm-hmm. He played all those types of roles exceedingly well.
Well, he did play some military types. And so what we associate with him, you know, if you're looking at The Great Santini or, of course, Apocalypse Now. And Dan, I don't know, I think you could have delivered that line better, considering you drove those same River Patrol boats in Vietnam. So
true.
But
and you probably encountered a Kilgore or two in your day.
Probably. I never did smell napalm.
Okay.
I also appreciated one of my favorites, and Dan, I think you would agree with this because we've watched it a couple of times, was his portrayal in Lonesome Dove. That was
the miniseries.
Yes, exactly. And so the fact that he apparently, from everything I've read, he truly immersed himself in these parts. And so, you know, if he was going to play a preacher, he would go out and like observe some preachers. If he was going to play, if he was interested in playing, you know, somebody with a particular accent, he would make sure that that it was as authentic as possible.
He could also play off other actors. I mean, one of the strengths of Lonesome Dove was his character was one of two former Texas Rangers with Tommy Lee Jones, who played Woodrow Call, and their teaming was so good. But each one of them was superb in that 8-hour miniseries.
I wanted to talk about a movie that you mentioned, Mary Pat, which is 1979's The Great Santini. The same year he was in Apocalypse Now, although I believe The Great Santini came out later. It had one of those weird staggered releases.
First, but came out later.
Something like that, yeah. And I have to be honest, this is not a movie I even have that much affection for, but I think in terms of his performances, this is a quintessential Duvall performance. And, you know, I think everybody remembers this movie for the antagonistic relationship that Duvall's Great Santini has with his teenage son, played by Michael O'Keefe. They were both nominated for Academy Awards for the movie. And he treats his son with the intensity of a drill instructor.
Yep.
There are occasional glimpses of warmth, but not very much. And there's that famous one-on-one basketball game between the two of them that gets more and more confrontational as it goes.
Yep.
And you could argue that Duvall actually has more of a supporting role in The Great Santini because he disappears for long stretches of it, and it's the O'Keefe character that takes the lead. But he looms over that whole movie. And I rewatched it after Duvall's death, and there was a bunch of stuff in it I had totally forgotten. It's based on a Pat Conroy novel, and it feels like they were trying to condense a lot of stuff into a two-hour movie.
Yeah. Pat Conroy does go on and on a bit.
He does, but you can't argue with Duvall's just hit the intimidating figure he cuts in that movie. Yeah. I mean, it's
well,
so
it was
good.
Based on Pat Conroy's life.
Yeah, it's semi-autobiographical.
And I got to tell you, I didn't have a Marine officer for a father, but I had a naval officer for a father, and that movie worked with me.
I bet.
My father was a kind of guy who would bounce quarters off my bed Saturday mornings inspections. So yeah, I could relate to that quite a bit.
Of course, we can't go on without talking about his performance as Tom Hagen, as the consigliere to the Corleone family in Coppola's Godfather movies. And he was in the first two. Apparently, he opted out of the third, which was probably a wise decision on his part over some compensation issues. Mm-hmm. But I thought that he was really, in many ways, you know, he was the sort of steady presence in that movie, you know, throughout.
Yeah.
Because you could see over time how he was gradually seduced by, you know, those around him while still trying to be the ballast against, you know, some of their...
The glue that holds them
together. Right, exactly.
And, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is his portrayal of the character Max Sledge, the one that won him in Tender Mercies, the one that won him the Academy Award of all his nominations. I mean, he and the actress Tess Harbor, they make this wonderful couple. And it's a film that could have been done so in such a cliche manner.
Mm-hmm.
But his ability to play this broken down alcoholic guy who rejuvenates his life with the help of this woman, it's a marvelous performance.
And I also want to say that we've been talking about him as an actor, but Duvall was a writer and director as well. Another one of my favorite performances is The Apostle from 1997, which he directed, he wrote, he produced, and he starred in. And he's this sort of fly-by-night Pentecostal preacher. He's drunk and he's violent and he flees.
He's kind of on the run, yes.
Yeah, he flees one Texas town for another. He sort of becomes this cause celeb in this small town. And what I like so much about that movie is that as an actor, Duvall isn't afraid to show us the worst of this character.
Right.
But as a filmmaker, he doesn't question the devotion of the character, the faith of the character. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty fascinating movie about the line that exists between morality and faith. So mm-hmm. that's one for people to see. I feel like that one has kind of fallen through the cracks over the years. Yet another film he was nominated for an Academy Award for.
Yeah. And another one is the movie Open Range, the 2003 movie Open Range.
Oh, Kevin Costner.
With Kevin Costner. Yeah. I mean, he played Boss Spearman there. He was, I think, was the best in those Westerns. And my favorite, Lonesome Dove. You just can't beat Lonesome Dove. That was our rundown of the career of the late actor Robert Duvall. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to discuss the career of the documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Public media is facing real challenges, including the loss of federal funding and growing pressure on independent journalism. But here's what hasn't changed: our commitment to Spokane and the Inland Northwest. Hi, I'm John Decker, Spokane Public Radio's president and general manager. This upcoming spring membership campaign is about sustaining that work, not just for today, but for the long term. So please help us get started by giving at SpokanePublicRadio.org. And thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the career of the late actor Robert Duvall. Let's now turn to the career of another recently deceased movie great, the documentary filmmaker Frederick Wiseman. When he died on February 16th, the day after Robert Duvall's death, the 96-year-old Wiseman was a revered figure among those who worked in documentary film. No less than a critical voice than Pauline Kael wrote that Wiseman was, quote, probably the most sophisticated intelligence to enter the documentary field in years. Oscar-winning director Errol Morris wrote this in a 2011 Paris Review essay. Wiseman's films prove a simple principle. Style does not determine content. Wiseman has never been a straight verite documentarian. He is a filmmaker and one of the greatest we have. A native of Boston, Wiseman earned a pair of college degrees and spent 2 years in the Army before taking a job at Boston University School of Law. It was there that he began his filmmaking career, beginning in 1963 with The Cool World, Shirley Clarke's film about an African-American youth gang that he produced. In his numerous subsequent films, few ever made him much money, and many were lengthy. His 1989 film Near Death is nearly 6 hours long. While he never received an actual Oscar, Wiseman was given a 2016 honorary one. He was also granted career achievement awards from both the Los Angeles Film Society in 2013 and the Venice Film Festival in 2014, and he won Emmy Awards for his documentaries Law and Order, 1969, and Hospital, 1970.
As you can well imagine, Wiseman is near and dear to my heart because not only is he a documentary filmmaker, he was a former law professor, and he also focused on topics that were almost all, at least early in his career, about social justice related issues. And so we'll talk just a little bit more about that later. But Wiseman's two films that I wanted to focus on for different reasons. The first is Titicut Follies. And people have probably heard about this film. It was made originally in 1967. And it's about Bridgewater State Hospital in Massachusetts, which was, quote, a facility for the criminally insane. But people were sent there either after having been determined to be incompetent to stand trial or not guilty by reason of insanity or awaiting some sort of evaluation. And he had actually, Wiseman had actually gone to Bridgewater State Hospital as a law professor with classes of students that he taught, which I think is, field trips to places that people might not typically see, I think is an essential part of education. So he went back and, filmed, and this is actually, Titicut Follies is actually one of his shorter films. And the name of the film is based on this talent show that they used to have on an annual basis at the institution. And he, but he just sort of sets his camera up. He never characterized himself as a cinema verite filmmaker, although some people would definitely put him in that category. But Weissman said he was an observational filmmaker. And indeed, he sort of sets his camera up and sees everything that's happening in this facility, the interrogations, and they truly are interrogations of the patients that are supposed to be evaluations. Their cruelty by the people who are overseeing them, the horrific conditions, which, by the way, Bridgewater State Hospital still exists today. And just 2 years ago, the disability rights organization in Massachusetts went in and issued an 87-page report about the poor conditions, including black mold and a variety of other deficiencies. So now we're talking about something we think that this is improved, and it really has not. And I think that that was one of Weissman's purposes in some of the films that he offered, because he wanted to show conditions as they were. And that was true with Titicat Follies, for sure. It was hung up in litigation for years and years. Because Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, claimed that there were patient privacy issues. And this has been a controversial topic among disability rights advocates because, you know, these people did get signed releases and so forth, as I understand it, because after all, Weissman was a lawyer. But it was really the state that didn't want this to be seen.
And I wonder why.
Yeah, really. And for a while, it was available for educational purposes. And finally, I think in 1990, it was more widely available to the public. And so I'll stop there and let the two of you sort of chime in, because I'm going to talk a little bit more about Domestic Violence, which he filmed in 2002, one of his later offerings of his 45 films.
Yeah, I want to back up a little bit and talk more about Weissman's style. You alluded to some of it, but I don't know if a lot of people listening to this have even seen a Frederick Weissman
movie. Because they are not that easy to find.
For a long
past.
Time, yeah. Now you can watch most of them on Canopy, by the way. And
available through your library card.
Yes, pretty much anyone you choose is going to have something fascinating in it. He was often linked to a movement in documentary called Direct Cinema. And if you think of the documentary as a medium for showing how people are and how life is actually lived, then Weissman may be the purest of all documentarians, because his movies have no talking heads, there's no narration, there's no text on the screen telling us who anyone is or even where we are. He simply stands back and observes. He drops us into the middle of things.
Totally immersive experience for us as the viewer.
Yes, he lets scenes run on, sometimes for minutes at a time. And as you mentioned, some of them are very long. Ultimately, I think you're right that his movies were fascinated with how systems work, how cultures and societies form, how they function. And he embeds us in these specific places. So maybe it's the Bridgewater Institution. Maybe it's a specific neighborhood, like in Jackson Heights. Maybe it's in a school.
A Montfort meatpacking plant in Greeley,
sure.
Colorado.
1968's high school, I think, is maybe the best entry point for his movies. Sometimes it's a library, like the New York Public Library in his film Ex Libris, or even a department store where he goes into one in Texas, I think, in the store. And he positions each of these things as microcosms of American life. So even though his camera is just simply observing and he doesn't interject himself into the action, by simply observing, he lets the people within his camera make his points for him. And so his style is objective, but his point of view very much is not. He is a political filmmaker.
Right. We need to point out, though, that he always declined to describe himself as a documentary filmmaker because he said, hey, I edit these things. I edit these things to make a point. So while you're right, absolutely, he does not have any commentary in there. You know, you can make, by clever editing, you can make the points that you want anyway.
Juxtaposition, framing,
exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, precisely. So I wanted to say the influence this guy had a personal effect on me, because in 1976, I happened to see his movie Meat, which came out right after his Is movie Welfare, which Welfare was almost a 3-hour long
movie.
And
don't you love the names of the movies?
I know. Yeah, by the way, Welfare is incredible.
It's been called a masterpiece. Yeah. Unfortunately, Meat was not called a masterpiece by most critics, and yet it had a tremendous influence on me because after seeing that movie, which was basically a study of, in this meatpacking plant, of these animals, sheep, swine, and cows, going from pens to becoming, you know, packaged meat, and you see the whole process. I was a vegetarian for 35 years. So, you know, this guy did have an influence on some of us. A terrific filmmaker.
Well, and I want to give a little bit of a shout out to his wife, Zipporah Weissman, who was a law professor herself at Northeastern and then subsequently at University of Texas. And she taught in the women's rights area in part. And so his 2002 film Domestic Violence takes place in a domestic violence organization in Tampa, Florida. And he does not dwell on the physical abuse that these women have suffered, although we do see some of that. There's, you know, but mostly it is focused on, again, as Nathan pointed out, how the system works and how.
Or doesn't work.
Right. Or doesn't work. Yeah. And so I think, you know, he, and in this film, like many others, he doesn't tell us at the end what should happen. I mean, he's just
resenting
it. His
movie's almost always like cut to black, and you're just sort of left to figure out, okay,
right,
what do I think about
right
all this?
What should happen here? And so I think that, you know, this film is more than 3 hours long. But again, if you're interested in this topic or working in this area, it's well worth seeing.
Yeah. Well, all his films are well worth seeing. You just have to understand that you're not going to have a whole lot of action. There are not going to be any exploding cars.
But there's going to be so much happening.
Oh,
and
so
And I would suggest that look for a subject that interests you
right,
and try it out. And that can be your starting point.
Precisely. At any rate, that was our discussion of the career of the late documentary filmmaker Frederick Weissman. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discuss the career of the late actor Robert Duvall. Let's take this moment to thank Aaron Bratt for directing the show and making us sound good. We thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best this cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these wise words from the late Robert Duvall. When I knew nothing, I thought I could do anything. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.